Like I said, last night we talked all about the buildup to the war. We talked about the decision-making and everything. Tonight, I actually want to focus on the actual course of the war, how the war is being fought. And as you know, this is an air and naval campaign so far. This is what the fighting looks like. The U.S. and Israel are deployed with their naval and air assets, and they are launching airstrikes over Iran. They are dropping tons of bombs, and they are hitting everything. They are bombing the missile launch platforms, missile production facilities. They are bombing Iran's navy. They're bombing the regime, the actual leadership of the government and of the military. Iran is retaliating. And how are they retaliating? Well, they have basically no other capability other than the missiles. They do not have a modern enough air force. They do not have an anti-aircraft system at all. Now they don't have a navy. They basically are incapable of doing anything other than launching short and medium range ballistic missiles, which are interceptable. But if they launch them in a large enough volume and across a broad enough swath of territory, eventually they're counting on the United States to not be able to intercept them. So the U.S. and Israel are hitting Iran. They say they've hit 1,700 targets. It's regime targets, military targets. It's all their assets. Iran retaliates with short-range, medium-range ballistic missiles against the following targets. They're going after U.S. bases in all of the Persian Gulf countries. So that is the United Arab Emirates. That's Bahrain. It's Qatar, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. They're hitting the U.S. bases in Erbil, which is Iraqi Kurdistan. They're hitting U.S. bases in Jordan. They're also striking the country of Israel, hitting military targets, government targets there. And they're also hitting civilian targets in the Gulf countries as well. So in addition to the U.S. bases in those countries, they're also actually hitting residential infrastructure, hotels, the civilian airport. Now, again, the United States, Israel, and the Gulf countries are able to intercept most of these missiles. So Iran has fired, I think in the first 24 hours, they fired 300 missiles, not a lot. And mostly these are being intercepted by U.S.-provided weapon systems. So we've put in place these Patriot missile batteries and THAAD batteries, as well as ballistic missile interceptors on the destroyers that are shooting down all the incoming missiles. The goal for Iran is to overwhelm these air defenses, either with large volleys of missiles in a single area or over a sustained period of time. If they can maintain the ability to launch the missiles, they're counting on the United States, Israel, and the Gulf to run out of interceptors, so they won't be able to shoot them down. And that has been the course of the war. Now, it is important to talk about what the actual strategic objectives are here, and to be very precise and specific. We talked about this in the buildup to the war, and it's equally, maybe arguably more important now. What Trump laid out on Friday is that this is a regime change war. So the strategic objective of the United States in the conflict, among others, is they are seeking a regime change. That is what they said. In addition to that, Trump said that they are seeking, the U.S. is seeking, to destroy Iran's navy and its ballistic missile capability. So that means, obviously, sinking all their ships, and also not just destroying the platforms that launch the missiles, but also the facilities where the missiles are produced. This is where it gets a little bit tricky, because Iran's missile production facilities and their launch platforms are fortified underground. So just like the complications with the nuclear program and the nuclear complex, the sites at Fordo and Natanz, where the centrifuges are buried under mountains and buried under the ground, it's the same story with the missiles. They have basically built entire cities fortified underneath the ground. And just look at a topographical map of Iran. It's all mountains. They build these cities underneath the ground, underneath thousands of feet of earth. And this makes it very difficult to destroy these completely and then to verify that the production facilities have been destroyed. And so even though Israel claims that these joint operations have destroyed half of Iran's ballistic missile launch platforms, It's an open-ended question whether we will be able to destroy all of them. And that raises some serious questions. But before we get into the missile aspect of the equation, because let's just say succinctly, for the sake of argument right now, the two strategic objectives here are regime change and destroying the missile launch capability. We'll talk about regime change first. This is maybe the most controversial operative word in this entire conflict, and maybe in the second Trump administration. Because historically, what a regime change means is that you kill the leader and you replace them with a different leader, and that new leader brings all his people in, and you just get a new country and you realign the country. So like in Iraq, we invaded, we put Saddam Hussein on trial, we executed him, we put all of his lieutenants on trial, we killed them, we killed all the remnant of the Ba'athist force, and others of them were integrated or re-educated. And now they have a democratic regime as opposed to a Ba'athist regime. And the same thing happened in Syria. We back proxies in Syria, we dropped tons of ordnance, we overthrew the Ba'athist Assad regime, and in its place is now a Sunni theocracy, effectively. We actually don't know the character of the new regime, but this new character, Ahmed al-Shara, formerly known as al-Julani, he is now in charge. He is a Sunni Muslim. It appears that he is reorienting Syria away from the fascist, pan-Arab socialist ideology of Ba'athism and towards something like, I'm not even quite sure what he's going for. They're maintaining a liberal structure, relatively liberal structure, but it is going to be a Muslim religious regime. All that being said, it's a completely new governing ideology, it's a new leader, and it's a new security apparatus. That is historically what regime change means in the Middle East. But with Trump, it's a little bit different. Because like we talked about with Venezuela, when Trump went into Venezuela in January, he did not actually have a real regime change. It appears that way, and it seems that way. Trump kidnapped Nicolas Maduro, who was the head of state and head of government, the president of Venezuela. And so people would say that appears to be a regime change operation because the head of state has been removed from power. However, you could argue this is more of like a hybrid approach. Even though Nicolas Maduro is no longer there, his vice president succeeded him and became president. Everybody else remained. It's the same cabinet, it's the same government, same defense minister, same intelligence minister, same interior minister, same the vice president is now the president, same army, same intelligence operation, same security apparatus. And they still ostensibly are a socialist Chavista regime. So is it safe to say that that's regime change? Not quite. It's more like a decapitation strike. And it's using decapitation as a menu item, as a tool, maybe call it smart power, for persuasion. In other words, rather than go to war against Venezuela in a conventional sense, to destroy their military and put everybody on trial and find new leaders and create a democracy, instead, we are picking off individuals in the government with these very surgical operations. I guess it's just the one. In the hopes that the successor will be more compliant to Washington. And so this is seen as a cost-effective, low-intensity way to reorient the posture of a hostile or revisionist country like Venezuela. And I think that in Iran, that is the same approach. So Trump laid out the case on Friday for a regime change. He said, this is a terrorist regime. They've been fighting us for years. They've killed Americans in Iraq and in Beirut and elsewhere. He said, so we're going to destroy their military. We want them to surrender. And then we want the people to rise up. Now, this is a little bit confusing because that would seem to indicate that he is talking about a full-fledged regime change because if he's degrading Iran's armed forces so that an uprising can occur, well, that would tend to imply that there will be a new regime, that the people of Iran are going to take power and they're going to create some kind of popular government, like a democracy or a liberal regime, but it will not be the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. It will not be the Islamic Revolutionary Regime. It will be something else. So that's the message we got on Friday. And that's what it sounded like, was full-fledged regime change. We're going to take care of their big guns, the cannons, the Navy, the missiles. And once we're done, then the people can rise up and they can create a free and independent and liberal regime. It seems, though, that Trump has been walking that back. And now they're talking about a different kind of regime change where Trump is talking about there may be candidates from within the existing government that will succeed the government that has been destroyed. So after the Ayatollah was assassinated in the initial strikes on Saturday, a council has been convened to operate the government and try to maintain some continuity. And today they elected a new supreme leader, and they're trying to keep everything together. Trump says that every candidate he had in mind to lead the country has been killed. He says, and we're almost done killing all the leadership. There have been some reports that Trump's plan all along was to decapitate enough of the leadership, destroy enough of the military, that eventually an element from within the regime would somehow take power and then negotiate with the United States. Seeing that the military is destroyed, seeing that Iran is totally defenseless, and recognizing that they face certain death, Trump is anticipating that a pragmatic element is going to seize power and they will initiate negotiations and give the United States what they want. Now, to me, that sounds like what happened in Venezuela. That sounds like if that is coming from inside the regime, then it's not a real regime change. If you were talking about an uprising of the people, that is a whole different undertaking. And we aren't there. There's a lot of opposition to the regime in Iran, but they're not cohesive, and they're not armed or trained, and they're not organized. So there is no alternative force. When he says you're going to rise up and take the country back, that's not going to happen. For that to happen, it will not happen spontaneously. That is something that would require careful planning and money and arms and training and all sorts of things. They would need some legitimacy from the people. It isn't there. So when Trump says now, well, maybe we're waiting on somebody from inside the regime to take the reins and let common sense prevail, that sounds like what happened in Venezuela, which is that the regime will be intact at the end of this. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard will be intact. The Iranian armed forces will be intact. The constitution, legislature, the structure, maybe even that they have a supreme leader. All of that will be intact. That's maybe the big idea. But like I said yesterday at the top of the show, this is a pure gamble. We don't know that that will happen. People say, is that going to happen? What are the odds it's going to happen? Frankly, nobody knows. Nobody has any idea because it is pure chaos. When you destroy the command, control, and communication of a country, you assassinate the supreme leader, you assassinate all their top military and civilian brass, what does the day after look like? Well, that actually depends upon the people that survive. And what do they decide to do? You don't really know. You're kind of gambling that they are going to see the light, so to speak. Now, here is why that seems to be unlikely. Here's why that's maybe a bad bet. Unlike Venezuela, Iran is a theocracy. It's built on a religion of martyrs. The Shiite Muslims, it's literally a religion of martyrs, and they have a theocratic religious government. So you have a regime. It's not just a huge regime of hundreds of thousands of loyalists that have been vetted, that have been tested, but it's also religious zealots. And the religious zealots that are, their religion is based on dying for God. So this infrastructure, this security apparatus made up of jihadists, of people that are willing to die for their religion, for their theocracy, for their leader, they just witnessed the United States and Israel lie to them, kill their leader, kill their colleagues, their friends, maybe their families. And the expectation is that this is going to make them more compliant. It would seem to be the case that it's more likely they will be emboldened and actually get a more hardline faction. Because what is the logic? The remnant, the survivors are going to say, see, you can't trust the United States. They tricked us. They killed us. This was inevitable. If anything, you're going to get hardliners in place. And Trump has basically admitted this. And we'll get into this in a moment, what the outcome is in that case. But Trump admitted this today. He said in the Oval Office, we actually might get a more hardline regime. He said that is going to be the worst case scenario. So that's the regime change angle. You're either going to get a regime change, a true regime change, and that is going to entail some kind of ground force. That's going to entail, you're talking about a popular uprising, which isn't there. It's going to be some kind of sectarian group or ethnic group, a separatist group, something like that, that again, will need to be armed and organized. Or you're looking at a decapitation strike that eventually results in compliance. And I think at this point, that is very far-fetched. Now, the other strategic objective is destroying the ballistic missile capability. So not only do we seek the termination of the Iranian regime, but also we want to destroy all the missiles. And why is that? The missiles are the only military capability that allow Iran to hit any strategic assets among our allies. They are going to have no air force, no navy, no nothing. The proxy network is in shambles. All they have are these missiles, and that is what they can use to hit Saudi Arabia. That is what they can use to hit ships in the Strait of Hormuz, and they can hit airports and tourist destinations in the Gulf countries, and of course, U.S. bases and Israel. So a big part of the push to war was about disarming Iran and making it so that they're not able to do this. Well, once again, many complications, because you can't actually bomb all their ballistic missiles. We don't know where they are, all of them. Many of them are highly mobile. This is the same problem we faced in Yemen. Last year in 2025, we launched a month-long war against the Houthi rebels in Yemen, and we had a carrier strike group off the coast, and we launched tons of airstrikes, and we hit them really hard. Same story. And we had literally no ability to prevent them from launching missiles. No effect. Think about that. In 1 month, we dropped more ordnance on the Houthis in Yemen than Joe Biden did in a year and a half. And it had no effect. And you might have heard about a year ago, aircraft carriers had to swerve to avoid being hit by missiles so sharply that planes were falling off the deck of the carrier. And we had, at the very end, to say, we surrender. Trump got up and said, I respect the Houthis. This isn't working. We're out. And to this day, the Houthis maintain the ability to launch the missiles. And the reason being is because the missile launch platforms are mobile. They're mobile. They're hard to detect with surveillance. And you have to destroy all of them. If Iran has any ability to launch ballistic missiles, and they have a lot of them, according to U.S. assessments from the Defense Intelligence Agency, they have the widest, biggest, most diverse missile arsenal in the Middle East. If you're going to do it, you got to destroy all of them. What happens if you don't? Well, again, the state of the play is that we are bombing them. We are trying to simply drop enough bombs that they submit. It's a very blunt tool, very blunt weapon. Iran is retaliating with missiles. Now, the equation that everybody is talking about with regard to the missiles is that Iran's ballistic missiles are much cheaper than the interceptor missiles that we use to shoot them down. And we need multiple interceptors per missile. And the interceptors do not have a 100% interception rate. We also produce them much more slowly, and these are spread out across the entire world. So think about all these variables here. Iran has tons of cheap supplies, cheap missiles. They're very inexpensive to make, and they're blasting them off. And we really have no ability to prevent them from launching all their missiles. And these missiles are raining down every day against a wide array of targets across the entire region. Hezbollah is launching them against Cyprus in the Eastern Med. Iran is launching them against Israel, but also against Jordan and Northern Iraq and Riyadh and Bahrain and the Emirates and Qatar and Oman. The whole region is being hit with missiles. And the ships in the Persian Gulf are being hit with missiles. Now, if you are trying to intercept these missiles, you can only deploy a finite number of systems to protect a finite number of targets. The detection, early warning, and interception, it's a smaller radius. So you have to deploy systems in all these different places. You can't leave Saudi Arabia out to dry. Because what happens if missiles start hitting the Eastern Province oil fields? You got a big problem. You can't leave the Emirates hanging out to dry, because what happens if they destroy Dubai? Obviously can't leave Israel hanging out to dry. And this is not even talking about the cargo ships in the Persian Gulf or the U.S. military personnel and facilities. So we're spread very thin. We're spread thin in the Middle East. We also have these systems in Asia in preparation for China's invasion of Taiwan. We have them in Europe to shoot down Russian drones, missiles, projectiles. So we're spread very thin. And even the resources we have, we can't replenish them easily. So we're using years worth of interceptor supplies in a matter of days. You're not going to see as many built for another 5-10 years. Then you have to factor in the cost. Iran is making them not just more quickly, and they don't just have more of them, and they're only using them in one theater of conflict, but also they're much cheaper. They're far cheaper. And you only need one to get through. Interceptors, you need to launch two or three. You need to launch multiple per missile. Not all of the missiles are going to be shot down. And so if the interception rate is 86%, as it was in the war last year, that's a significant number of missiles that might be getting through. And if the war drags on for weeks or months, it becomes a war of attrition. Who is going to run out first? Are we going to run out of our very finite, very limited stockpile, very expensive interceptors, which are not always effective? Or is Iran going to run out of their very cheap missiles and drones, which they have underground factories to churn these out by the hundreds every month? The answer is very obvious. And what that tells us about the conflict is that it is in our interest for this to be fast. That is the insight that you have to derive from this. If that is the calculus, we cannot tolerate the Gulf and our bases and Israel being hit with missiles for weeks and months, because we can't shoot them all down. And if we can't shoot them all down, it is ruinous. There's no tourism. There's no commerce. People are fleeing. It's very destabilizing. So this cannot be a long war for us. It has to be short. And this gives you some insight into Trump's thinking here. You have to imagine that Trump was thinking that he was going to hit Iran so hard, kill all their leadership, and even if we couldn't destroy all their missiles, we could get someone in the government to make a deal. And it really seems like that was the play, once you understand that this had to be a quick war. It cannot be a long war. And it would require a very long and pitched battle to topple the regime. So this tells you what Trump was thinking. Well, it looked very one-sided in the opening stages of the conflict when we were just having our way in Iran's airspace, dropping all these bombs. But now that the Iranians are not surrendering, and now that they're still maintaining the ability to launch missiles into the Persian Gulf and elsewhere, now you got to wonder, well, what is the off-ramp here? What's the exit plan? If the gamble was, we're going to hit them really hard and we're going to hope that someone is going to take the reins, well, again, what happens if they don't? Now we're kind of screwed because we're running out of this supplies and it's a race against the clock. Either we destroy the missile launch platforms and it's a non-issue, or we don't, and then we're in a real pickle here. So what was plan B? If plan A was we're going to hit them really hard and then, well, plan B is quite obvious. It's ground forces. How do you destroy the missile launch platforms? How do you disable Iran's capabilities? You have to send in a ground force. That's the only thing that'll do it. And if you have air power, if you take out their airplanes, if you have air superiority, if you take out some of their major assets, then maybe it becomes possible to deploy a small force inside the country. Who knows, to secure the nuclear sites, to secure the ballistic missile sites. And this is Trump. Trump said yesterday that he's not ruling out boots on the ground. This is the story from the Times. It says, quote, President Trump told the New York Post on Monday that he is not ruling out sending ground troops into Iran if it was necessary, adding that Operation Epic Fury was way ahead of schedule after taking out dozens of Tehran's top officials. He said, quote, I don't have the yips with respect to boots on the ground like every other president. There will be no boots on the ground. I don't say it, Trump said. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth said at a Monday morning Pentagon press conference that no American troops are currently inside Iran, though he also did not rule out the possibility. He said, President Trump ensures our enemies understand we'll go as far as we need to advance American interests, but we're not dumb about it. You don't have to roll 200,000 people in there and stay for 20 years. Trump told the Daily Mail on Sunday he estimated the war would last 4 weeks, but hinted that the time frame could be shortened. He said, it's going to go pretty quickly. We're right on schedule, way ahead of schedule in terms of leadership, 49 killed, and that was going to go for 4 weeks. We did it in 1 day. So they're saying it out loud. They're saying, if we can't get Iran to capitulate, we'll send in a ground force. Trump says, I'm not ruling that out in principle. And Hegseth says, we may not invade like we did in Iraq. Maybe we'll do a smaller force, maybe special forces. But Hegseth too says, we're not going to rule it out either. That seems to be the only possible alternative. If you're not able to drop bombs enough to get them into submission and they're going to hand over their missiles and their nuclear program and make peace with Israel, someone's going to have to go in and kill them. Someone, some force on the ground with guns is going to have to go in and do this intense fighting to actually raid these facilities, raid this. And here's the problem. This is a country three times the size of Iraq. So we had an invasion force of 200,000 invade Iraq in 2003. And that country is one third the size. And not only that, Iran is all mountains and desert. So it's a mountainous country, three times bigger than Iraq, population three times bigger. And they're telling us we're going to need a force that is smaller. It's going to be less complicated. It'll take less time. How does that even make sense? You deploy American troops, what exactly is the plan here? Okay, we dropped all these bombs. Newsflash, they're still standing. There's still 200,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and they're not giving up. Okay, what do you do now? Well, we're going to send in a ground force. We're not ruling that out. And what are they going to do? Seriously, how are you going to go in there? Short of 500,000 soldiers, how are you going to go in and invade? And where and when and what does that even look like? And by the way, what happens then when Americans start dying? So Americans land on the ground and all of a sudden they're getting shot with shoulder-launched rockets and they're getting blown up with IEDs. And Iran is going to change their tactics into a defense of the homeland. Repel the invader. There's going to be no collaborators on the ground. They're going to want the Americans out. So now the country is disintegrating, okay? The people are not able to get food and water and critical infrastructure. Everybody's trying to flee. You probably have a refugee crisis coming imminently. With the IRGC being decapitated over and over again, law and order breaks down. Then you've got Americans in there. What is happening in this country? Well, it's going to completely destabilize. It's going to totally come apart. Is there a civil war between different factions? Maybe you have an IRGC remnant, and then you have U.S. loyal opposition, and then you have Kurds, and what does that look like? And then again, what exactly have we gotten ourselves into? Are we now going to have thousands of Americans dying, trying to put Iran back together in a civil war, trying to rebuild some semblance of law and order? What exactly are we on the hook here for? Now, that is the other alternative. And it has been mentioned, is that we might use an already on the ground force to be our ground force in Iran, like, for example, the Kurds, which are Iran's largest ethnic minority. It's about 10 to 15% of the population concentrated in the northwest part of the country. And this is the story about that. Apparently, Trump and Netanyahu had spoken to the Kurds a week before the war started. And specifically, they talked about the Kurds being an invasion force, that the Iraqi Kurds in northern Iraq, armed and supported with U.S. air power, would cross the border with Iran, and they would be our invasion force. This is from Axios. It says, quote, President Trump spoke by phone with Kurdish leaders in Iraq on Sunday to discuss the U.S.-Israel war with Iran and what might come next. Trump spoke to leaders from the two main Kurdish factions in Iraq a day after the Saturday bombing campaign began. The calls were the culmination of months of behind-the-scenes lobbying by Prime Minister Netanyahu. Israel has had close security, military, and intelligence ties with the Kurds in Syria, Iraq, and Iran for decades. It is the general view, and certainly Netanyahu's view, that the Kurds will come out of the woodwork. They're going to rise up, said one of the officials. 6 days before the war began, five dissident Kurdish groups sheltering in Iraq announced the formation of the Coalition of Political Forces of Iranian Kurdistan to fight Iran. Well, U.S. policymakers believe Netanyahu might have overestimated the number of Kurds who might take up arms against Iran. It's not nothing, they said. Well, that's good to know. It's not nothing. That's what you want to hear. Before you invade a country of 90 million people with 200,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guard, what you want to hear is, hey, well, we don't have absolutely nothing at all. It's something. Oh, okay. That's reassuring. And this was always the plan. The plan, because this is what has happened in Iraq. The Kurdish third of Iraq is effectively autonomous. There was sort of a brief civil war about 10 years ago between the government in Baghdad and the Kurds. Iraq is effectively controlled by Iran because part of Iraq's security architecture includes a militia army called the Popular Mobilization Forces, and most of them are Shiite Muslims loyal to Iran. And they have launched bombs at Israel, and they have criticized the United States, and they operate in every governorate in Iraq, except for in Iraqi Kurdistan in the north. And the Iraqi Kurds had fought for independence, fought for a semi-autonomous government system, and this is where American soldiers retreated to. When the Iranian missiles started flying, we took our troops out of Baghdad, and we put them in Erbil. We put them in Iraqi Kurdistan. Now, the Kurds are huge allies of Israel because they are a destabilizing force. They are the largest ethnic group in the world without a country. They have large numbers in southeastern Turkey, northeastern Syria, northern Iraq, and northwestern Iran. And there are a lot of them. And what the Israelis and to some extent the Americans do is they use the Kurds against these governments. Diversity becomes our secret weapon. Who do we go for? People that are dissatisfied with the government, that oppose it, that are going to take up arms against the regime? It is the disenfranchised, disaffected ethnic minority, the Kurds. And so we use the Kurds in Syria, and we use the Kurds in Iraq, and we are using the Kurds in Iran. And so Israel and the U.S. have these pre-existing ties throughout these conflicts with ISIS, against Saddam Hussein, against Assad. And we are now using those contacts and using this military to create something like an invasion force across the border. And the idea is that the Iraqi Kurds are going to cross into Iran. And where is this uprising going to occur? In the western part of the country. The western part of Iran is mostly Kurdish. And so if a lot of armed, organized Kurds backed by Israel, backed by the CIA, backed by the U.S., if they cross over the border as a military unit, well, they will probably be liberated, or rather greeted as liberators, by the Kurds that are already living in Iran. And then the question is, where does that lead? Does that turn into a full-scale uprising against the government? It's hard to see how it does. And they even admit in this article, we don't really have the numbers. It's all a numbers game. There's a lot of Kurds, but nowhere near as many as there are Persians. And you got a lot of Kurds in one part of the country, but Iran is a very big country. So that's where you start to imagine maybe there's a hybrid approach. And maybe it looks something like You back the Kurds in the north, and they cross over the border and invade, and they liberate the Kurds that are already there. And this becomes like a military force now. This becomes the beachhead. And the U.S. has their air base in Iraq, and now you have a land bridge across the border into Iran, where the Kurds have established this beachhead inside the country. And so you can then begin supplying weapons, and you can fly in. And then maybe that is aided by special forces. Maybe that's aided by a U.S. ground presence. Maybe on the eastern side of the country, you get a Balochistan separatist group. There's another ethnic minority, the Baloch, in southeastern Iran. They're very restive, and they have some separatist groups there. Maybe it becomes a two-pronged attack, and they meet in the middle. Maybe something like this is in the cards. Either way, once again, what exactly is the plan? Because what it is sounding like more and more is that this is going to turn into a ground war. It is going to turn into a ground war with us. Because again, just like it happened with the nuclear program and the missiles, all you have to do is think about these strategic imperatives. We need to destroy their missiles. We need to secure the nuclear material. We want Iran to capitulate. Otherwise, it isn't worth it. Israel actively seeks the end of the revolutionary regime. So if the U.S. and Israel want these things, they're not leaving without them. They're not going to give up and go home and let Iran keep bombing them or rebuild or get emboldened, have a hardliner come to power, and it's even worse. They're not going to let that happen. They would sooner escalate and take it further than allow this window of opportunity to close and actually to have worsened the situation. Okay, so if failure is not an option, and if Iran does not surrender, and if we can't bomb them into submission or destruction, then what is going to absolutely have to happen? Some ground force is going to have to go in. It doesn't matter who, but someone is going to have to go in. And from these discussions, it looks like that is the Kurds, but we know that they are not enough. We know they have deep ties to the U.S. and Israel. We know they are not enough. So what it is starting to sound like is that inevitably, that is where this is going to go. The country is going to destabilize. The regime will not capitulate. We may be incapable of destroying everything that they have. And so in the end, we're going to have to back some kind of popular uprising, some kind of hybrid, a mix of liberal anti-government forces, secessionists and separatists like the Kurds or Balochistan. And yes, maybe some kind of U.S. ground presence. But I don't see how you get to the end of the year. I don't see how you get to the end of this administration with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard intact. It's going to go. The question is just when and how. And we know the how. It has to be boots. So that's what it's going to be. And you know something? It's interesting that this is now being admitted by Netanyahu and Trump and the Kurds, because I said this about the protests in January. If you remember in January, when all of this started, when the uprising began in Iran and it became the deadliest protest, and every paper of record in the United States, it was just the front page was all about the atrocities that the Iranians were committing against the protesters. And that is when the United States and Israel were going to intervene. Now, there were reports when this was happening that the so-called protesters were actually not protesters at all. There were eyewitness accounts that the so-called protesters were clad in all black uniforms, were using professional tactics, were armed with automatic weapons, and they were targeting and seizing government buildings. That's not a protest. That's not a student uprising. And they talk about that woman who burned the photo of the Ayatollah with her cigar. That's not that. You know, she's not wearing all black, storming the regional government headquarters with an automatic weapon. That's not that. When you talk about people that are in uniforms but not holding a flag, what that is a proxy force. And where did the protests occur? Yes, they took place all across Iran, but where were the most casualties? Where were Iranian Revolutionary Guard getting killed the most? Where were the government buildings being taken over? It was all in the western part of the country. It was all in the Kurdish majority provinces of Iran. And I said this last month, I said, I would bet you that that was a Kurdish invasion. That was not a spontaneous uprising. That was not the will of the people and the protesters. I said, that is an invasion of a proxy force over Iraq's border into Iran. And it failed. It was repelled. Now that changes everything, doesn't it? Because it's just like everything else. The way that they framed it is that Iran was brutally cracking down on protesters, indiscriminately firing into the crowd. They were just telling people, hey, come find your loved ones in a body bag. Really? Because what this looks like is that you tried to invade Iran and Iran shut it down. They killed those people. They brutally killed those people and they shut down the internet because they were being invaded, because we attacked their country. And then when it failed, it was laundered by the propaganda machine as a humanitarian disaster. The protesters tried, they failed, they went in, and then they were executed. And that's yet another reason why we have to intervene and destroy Iran. Think about the timeline. They say 6 days before this war began in what is now last month, February, all the Kurdish anti-Iranian groups got together. You think that's a coincidence? What a coincidence. 6 days before diplomacy collapsed, the United States moved everything into place and initiated the conflict. All the Kurds came together and it looks like they're going to invade Iran. Maybe that's the plan B. If Iran doesn't surrender and we can't keep this war going on indefinitely and we need a swift end to it, achieving our strategic objectives, that's going to be that missing ingredient. But again, they're not going to be able to do it on their own. So that implies that we're going to go in. And I hope that's not the case, but I think at this point, it looks likely. Question is, just what exactly is the plan? What is the end game? And sadly, I don't think there's even an inkling of that. So we're going to watch how this plays out. We'll watch how it unfolds. Of course, it could go the other direction too. It's possible that there is a faction in the IRGC that is going to take power and negotiate with the United States. It's possible. It's just that we don't know. It's a gamble. It's a huge risk to take. And it's not very good odds. Again, the character of the regime, the character of the country, they have full faith and confidence that they're going to survive this. That they have time on their side, they have their missiles, and they're going to survive. And all they need to do is get through the worst of it, and then on the other side, they're just going to be more hardline, and they're just going to rebuild everything. And they can. Missiles are cheap, and they have centrifuges. They have the technology. They got it. So if the war ends, and then they emerge from the rubble, you know where we're going to be in 6 or 9 months? Right back where we started. Right back, we're going to get all over again. Iranians building missiles again. We think they're building their nuclear program again. And so either Iran totally capitulates, which is very unlikely, or we surrender due to political pressure from Congress or from the public or something, and the regime survives. If the regime survives, then all that is going to happen is that the Israelis are going to hit them really hard, and they may keep the war going in perpetuity. If Iran's missiles are depleted but not altogether destroyed, maybe Israel will just keep the conflict going at a low boil, constantly degrading the regime and waiting for that revolutionary force to come together. And then the last option is that, again, you get an American-backed force with U.S. assistance, a hybrid force, maybe comprising the Kurds, anti-government forces within Iran, maybe other separatists, and we swiftly bring down the government. And that seems to be right now the outlook on the conflict. And I got to say, just at what point do you learn your lesson? Who needed this? And we kind of did this last night. I don't want to get too much into the rhetoric here. You all get it. But think about what is happening in our country. Think about what just happened. We had a few thousand Border Patrol in Minneapolis. We are being ripped off by Somalians. Nobody wants these people here. They fucking suck. Okay? And people say, well, many of them are citizens. Who cares? Take their citizenship away. Many of them are naturalized. Take their citizenship away and get as many of them out of the country as possible. Nobody wants them here. There have been nothing but trouble since they got here. They don't even vote Republican, and they're scamming us. We put a few thousand Border Patrol in Minneapolis to see this through, and we couldn't even do it for a month. So think about it. We go in heavy, think about the contrast. We go in heavy to Minneapolis for our own tax dollars. They're stealing our money, and then they're sending it to Somalia. We're literally liberating our tax dollars, our city, our country. And after two protesters died, Trump said, you know what? This is way too unpopular. We got to get out of here. And they drew down the force expeditiously, and now they're out. And people are disputing this. There is no dispute. People say, well, that's because Minneapolis and Minnesota capitulated. No, they didn't. They did not. Tim Walz and Jacob Fry both say, we have not changed a single policy. And the ICE raids are over. So we retreated from Minneapolis, where we were fighting to liberate America from illegal immigrants, so that we could focus on deploying, apparently now boots on the ground, into Iran for regime change. Why exactly? They're not a threat to our country. They have no missiles that can reach us. They have no ability to touch us. They are not a threat. And allegedly, we destroyed their nuclear program. So what are we even doing there? We don't like the regime. So we're now going to commit all this energy and time and money and personnel and resources to overthrow it. Meanwhile, this is what happens in America. Meanwhile, the Haitians are still in Springfield. The Somalians are still in Minneapolis. The Venezuelans are still in Texas. There's still 40 million illegal immigrants here. You couldn't do an invasion force for your own country, but you can do it for Iran. Okay, got it. And the other thing that's funny about this, in the end, what will Iran be destroyed by? Their diversity. Who is protesting the regime in Iran? Liberals, college students, women, racial and ethnic minorities. What does that tell you? Who are the biggest allies in the war against the Iranian regime? Liberals, college students, women, racial and ethnic minorities. Iran is fighting for their sovereignty. You understand that, right? They're fighting so that they do not have to capitulate to Washington and Israel. They want to be free, independent, strong. And in order to do this, they need a siege mentality. They have turned their country into a fortress. They need to pursue strategic weapons. They need to prepare for war. That's why the economy sucks. And a lot of people sort of understand that. And maybe they have aspirations for sovereignty. But if an outside force wants to rape your country, because that's what this is, it's rape, we're raping them. We want their government to submit to us forcefully. Who is going to be our ally as we murder them, as we drop bombs and laugh, as we slaughter them, as we destroy their country? Who is the greatest ally of the evil outside force raping you, taking your freedom, taking your sovereignty? Women, students, liberals, racial and ethnic minorities. It's going to be an army of Kurds, literally an army of knuckle-dragging mudslimes, the most primitive people in the Middle East, and they're just a grieved minority. It's going to be stupid bitches that don't want to wear the burqa. They want to dance and they want to go on OnlyFans and trannies and stuff like that. It's the stupid young people that are brainwashed in universities where they have Western influence. And it is liberals, liberals, liberals that want elections, liberals that want an open society. Yeah, well, why do you think that favors Israel? Because an open society can be penetrated. An open society is wide open, open for business. Yes, we will take your foreign contributions in our elections. Yes, we will take your National Endowment for Democracy-backed press and student groups, because that's freedom. Liberalism is a cancer. And by liberalism, I don't mean like progressives. I mean liberalism. It makes us weak. It makes us vulnerable. Those are the vulnerabilities in Iran. Feminism, diversity, and voting. It couldn't be more simple. Their diversity is invading their country to topple their government. Their women are creating the propaganda to destroy their government. It's like, who would win? This 85-year-old cleric who, like, gave his life to his country and religion, turned his country into a fortress made out of missiles and nukes? Or like some stupid bitch that just wanted to dance? Some stupid bitch who doesn't understand anything, who is like, I want to have fun. I want to go out and party like they do in the West. And liberals. And liberals who say, well, we just want an open society where we can vote. We don't want this oppressive regime. Well, you open up the society and you open it up to all that foreign influence from the US and Israel. And that's why they don't want it. Same reason China has a great firewall, and you're sort of starting to understand why. We used to think that the Chinese and the Iranians had a cyber firewall to keep their people in. They didn't want their own people to know about Tiananmen Square, and they didn't want their own people to know about their corruption, and so on. In reality, it was about keeping the West out. It was about, because what is the West going to do? We're going to destabilize their country. If there was no great Chinese firewall, we would bombard their country with anti-China propaganda. We would be talking about the Uyghurs, and we would be vilifying the regime and all sorts of things. And it would destabilize China. And you start to see this in America, where you go on Twitter and it's all foreign influence. All of it. It's all Israel. It's all India. It's a lot of the Muslims too. Let's be honest. It's Russians. It's a lot. It's the CIA. Our internet is being pumped full of propaganda. And you look at Iran, a country that is on the verge of collapse. It's a country that's being killed. Their vulnerabilities were those three things. Those are the three things that bring ruin to a nation. It's diversity, it's women, and it's tolerance. It's openness. And this is food for thought for America. If there was some country that wanted to destroy America, would they back a Mexican force to invade America and liberate the Mexicans in LA? Let's say as an example, I mean, that sounds crazy, but as an example, would they back BLM rioters to destroy the cities? Would they go for the women and, you know, try to make it into some kind of women's rights things? And then, of course, the open society, they already take advantage of it. This is how they destabilize a country. So there's a lesson in this. This is why Israel doesn't tolerate a lot of that stuff. So that's that. That's the situation in Iran. It's like a waking nightmare. But like I said, we're going to keep an eye on it. We're going to keep you updated on everything. With that, we're going to move on. We're going to take a look at our super chats. We'll see what you guys have to say about all this. Much to consider, much to think about. 2026, yeah, I'm thinking no. Thinking I'm not going to vote for anyone. Where's my, there it is. I'm out. And I'm already getting attacked. Everybody's already attacking me. You're a Democrat. You're a Fed. You know what my answer is now? Fuck you. Fuck you. I am in my era of I don't give a fuck anymore, okay? I'm seriously over it. Like, I am past it. I'm in my villain era. I'm in my era of I don't give a fuck. People are saying, you're a Democrat. You're a Fed. It's like, hey, asshole. We are at war with Iran, okay? Wake up, like, trust the plan, vote for Trump. What are you, 8 years old? You can call me a Democrat. You can call me whatever you want. I'm playing both sides, okay? We play both sides like Chanel. We're playing both sides, Democrat, Republican. I am going with whatever hates my enemies more. And right now, Republicans are my enemies. I want to destroy them. People say, well, you know, but the Democrats are going to do all this stuff and the Democrats, the Republicans brought us to war in Iran. Period. End of story. I'm not listening anymore. You're not getting through. I will not be gaslit. And this is what people need to do. At a certain point, people are going to make up their minds. You're going to have to make your decision, okay? And a lot of people don't love this. I get DMs all the time. People say, you're making a big mistake. You're not going to... Make up your mind. You make your decision. I've made mine. I can only speak for myself. I am a citizen. I am an American. I have a vote. I'm not giving my vote to this treacherous administration. I'm not voting for the party that brought us to war in Iran for Israel. I will never do that. Never. You can do whatever you want. If you have more tolerance for bullshit, hey man, knock yourself out. Another sucker is born every day. You want to vote for that because the Democrats are worse? Hey man, go for it. I'm not doing it. And to the extent that people are going to attack me on that basis and say, you know, like I said, all the usual allegations, try to destroy my reputation, it's only because they're afraid of that outcome. They don't want white people to know their power. They don't want the base to know its true power. They don't want us to rise up and develop our own political consciousness and start fighting for our own interests. They want to keep us complacent, keep us asleep. You can be angry, but you got to keep voting. You can be upset, but you got to keep playing the game. I'm not playing the game. I don't play games. I flip over the table. I don't like what I'm getting. I flip over the table. I play a new game. And that's where I'm at right now. I have had it, and I'm going to do something about it. Aren't you tired of bitching? I've had it. Now I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to vote for the Democrats because fuck you. People are saying, we're going to go on Twitter and we're going to voice our dissent. That gets us nowhere. That's doing nothing. We tried that. We voted for this. Well, you voted for this in 24. It didn't work. So now I'm trying something else. I'm going to do something about it. And the more they panic, the more I know I'm doing the right thing. The more that people who are paid to lie to me call me out for this, the more I know I'm doing the right thing. People that are literally paid money under the table to peddle influence, soft money influence, these people are out there saying, hey, everybody, it's okay as long as there's no boots on the ground. Here's how we could still win. If people that are being paid to lie to my fucking face, sending my country into a war that we have no business fighting, if those people are telling me, oh, you're a Democrat plant, you're a Fed, well, then I know I'm in the right because those people are the fucking enemy. They are the enemy. They hate you. They treat you with contempt. Contempt in every word. And you know what's funny? I've seen it. I've seen people that have defended this administration in a disgusting fashion. Whores. Whores. With no dignity, whores on their hands and knees with no dignity. It's filthy. It's disgusting. I think about people like Andrew Isker. I think about people like Andrew Isker, this fat endomorphic idiot. He's been on Twitter for 2 years saying, got what I voted for. Oh, got what I voted for. I'm a fat idiot. I'm a fat, stupid goy. I'm a goy in abundance. And this guy has done nothing but cocksuck the administration since they got in. He has done nothing but make excuses, trust the plan, all the rest of it. I see this guy this weekend. He goes, you know what? I supported this administration, but I don't like this. He goes, I'm against the war with Iran. This doesn't seem good. And immediately he's getting attacked. Immediately he's getting attacked by all his own people. And I see him post on Twitter. He goes, look, guys, I'm not a Democrat. I'm a plan truster. I'm not a third worldist or a panikin. I've trusted the plan. Honest. I'm not a third worldist. I'm a heritage American. He goes, but I don't want a war with Iran. He's literally pleading with them. They flipped on him on a dime. That's who we're dealing with. It is a gaslighting psyop. All of it. I saw the same thing happen to Aiden. I saw the same thing happen to Aiden on X from AF Post. He's like Jeb Bush. It was a mistake. It wasn't a mistake until he finally decided it was a mistake. When we launched the war in Iran, he goes, you know, you guys just don't get it. It's about China. This is great. And then within 2 days, he goes, I have a feeling we did this for Israel. You don't say. Oh, really? We invaded Iran for Israel? You don't say. If only someone was warning us. If only someone was warning us. But even him and the same story. Now, Captive Dreamer is calling him out. Captive Dreamer calls out Aiden on X. You're a disloyal Panikin. You're a disloyal R. And so these people, they need to lose. I don't even care. They just need to lose. I don't care if the Democrats win. These people need to lose because they hate you. How much do you have to hate a person to lie to their face and tell them, I'm on your side, I'm working for you, I'm on your team, I'm a patriot, we just have to do this, and they're being paid to sell you something that will hurt you. How much do they have to hate you? I think they hate you even more than the Democrats do. Even the plan trusters are not spared from that. So that's why I say, I'm leaning in. I'm leaning in. I'm on lean and I'm leaning in. Yeah. My vote for the Democrats is a middle finger to the GOP. I don't care. Say what you want. People say that's a dumb idea. I don't care. That's what I'm doing. I've made up my mind. You have pissed me off royally, and that is now what I will do. And if they want to win in 28, you got to find somebody else. I will not vote for Vance. I will not vote for Rubio. They brought us this. You don't want to repeat this in 28? Give me somebody I can vote for. Give me somebody that's America first. Otherwise, give it to the Democrats. I'll flee. I'll go to Vietnam. I'm out. Country's coming down anyway. What does it matter? And this is what you guys need to understand. This country is fucked. Okay. And the only thing that is going to turn this country around is radical change. Not moderate reform, radical change. If the Republicans are not giving us radical change, they're just giving us collapse at a slower pace, right? They're liberals driving the speed limit. They're standing in front of liberals yelling stop and being rolled over, being steamrolled. So that's actually not a solution. Telling everybody we're going to have whites become a minority at a slightly slower rate and, you know, Israel's still going to run the country and so on. Yeah, that doesn't get us. I don't know what we're buying time for at that point. We have to stop playing not to lose and start playing to win. And that means taking ourselves seriously to start voting for ourselves, voting for our own interests, voting as a block rather than going with Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and Israel every year. It's what it is.